This is EU Scream Book Club. Coming up, a book about turning Europe into a vigorous parliamentary democracy, The Scent of Wild Animals by Sophie Inteveld. The European Union is a political experiment. It has the trappings of democracy, a parliament, a high court, and executive powers. But it's not a state, and national governments still have ways of stopping policies they don't like. The odd accommodation has helped foster prosperity and shared values for decades. But that's not working anymore, says the prominent Dutch liberal politician Sophie Inteveld. Sophie says the EU's ability to deliver results is breaking down. And in a new book, she identifies her main culprits. First and foremost is the European Council. It's made up of 27 heads of state and government who hold regular summits and give another body, the European Commission, which drafts and enforces EU laws, its general direction. But the European Council increasingly seems to include obstructive bullies, like Viktor Orban, who use blocking tactics to threaten democracy and human rights. A second culprit is Sophie's own institution, the European Parliament. The Parliament has 705 directly elected MEPs, yet as an institution, it's become woefully timid in holding other branches of the EU to account. Sophie's remedies include ending the Parliament's deference to the European Council and emboldening the Parliament to dismiss the European Commission when it fails to enforce EU law. Sophie's approach reflects her long-held federalist aspirations that her critics say destroy the EU's delicate dispensation. But Sophie says the EU may be on borrowed time anyway. She insists the EU's survival depends on overcoming creeping sclerosis, ending acquiescence to autocrats, and becoming a forum for the kind of political spectacle that captures the public's imagination. That means becoming far more robustly democratic, and far less politically, alien. Sophie, in your new book, you identify a UGO at the top of the European Union's power structure. What does UGO stand for, and do we have contact with these aliens?
Well, UGO or UGO is an unidentified governing object, and it refers to the European Council, so the Council of Government Leaders. And I came up with this idea because if you look at the governing structures of the European Union, and if you look at it from the perspective of the separation of powers, then it's actually really difficult to establish what the European Council is. What kind of creature is it? Is it an executive like a government? Is it a legislator like a parliament? Is it? It's not a judiciary. What is it? It has no mandate. It cannot be voted down by anyone. Its members cannot be voted down. And yet it's the most powerful institution in the European Union.
Actually, Sophie, if I may, this UGO, this unidentified governing object, it's not really unidentified at all. I mean, this group of heads of state and government, the European Council, it is the most visible part of the European Union machinery.
The European Council is the highest political body of the European Union. In the European Council, the democratically elected leaders of all member states get together. They do so to take the big decisions for the union, where only the leaders can really take the decisions. They meet alone. They don't have their officials with them. A lot is happening behind the scenes.
In a way, maybe that's what's such an irritation for you. The most visible part, perhaps in your mind, should be the European Parliament.
No, it's not. I'm not so much irritated by that, but I find it extremely worrying that we have a body that's growing ever more powerful and is increasingly dysfunctional. It's not delivering. For example, it has held migration policies hostage for like 6 or 7 years now, and we cannot force it to move. I mean, in a country where you have a government, if the parliament is unhappy with the performance of the government, it can vote the government down or it can force the government to act. Here, you know, there's nothing we can do.
And your book gives us this image of national representatives arriving at the council building in Brussels, not with the ambition for Europe, but with, and this is in your book, a purely national mindset and a briefcase, quote, full of red lines.
Yes, that's a big part of the problem. People want Europe to act, and yet the European Council is blocking everything. And that seems to be its task in life, to limit European action to the absolute minimum. And their crisis, I mean, now we're talking about COVID, for example, and climate change, but we have already forgotten almost about the financial crisis, which is now, you know, 12, 13 years ago. And the thing is that ever since the sense of urgency has faded, they've stopped completing the banking union. And we see this actually across the board, that they sort of half build a European structure. We see this with Frontex, the border and coast guard, and we see it with data protection. I mean, you name it. And everywhere the European Union is becoming paralyzed, sclerotic. And this has everything to do with the fact that the European Union is becoming more and more intergovernmental. It is the national capitals that are calling the shots. And this is very problematic.
But I think the biggest issue for you is the failure, even the refusal of the Council to uphold the rule of law in countries like Hungary, Poland, and Slovenia. And here you draw an intriguing parallel between the European Council's queasiness about holding its own members to account with how the Republican Party in the United States has closed ranks after the January 6th Capitol riot.
Well, you see the same mechanism at work, I think. So there is this body, whether it's the European Council or the US Republican Party, and they are deeply uneasy with the populists and the autocrats in their midst. And yet they feel even more uneasy about expelling one of theirs, or maybe strengthening, let's say, external mechanisms to keep the autocrats in check. The same way that, for example, the Republicans have basically killed the impeachment process, here you see the European Council killing the Article 7 procedure.
Europe has come up with different ways of limiting backsliding on democracy and rule of law. From Article 7, which could see the suspension of voting rights, to linking EU funding to the respective rule of law, and now an annual rule of law review.
I call them the enablers, just as Mitch McConnell himself may not be, you know, a corrupt autocrat, but he has enabled Trump. And we see the same happening in the European Council. And if you look at the European Council, I mean, the most powerful body in the European Union counts amongst its members people that we would not tolerate in most of our governments. And that's amazing. I mean, if you see, like, the council summit, and they were supposed to talk about Poland, and then they first argued for a long time whether they should be talking about Poland at all. Then they did, sort of informally, for 2 hours, and there was nothing in the council conclusions. Now, this is Poland, which is the worst case. Never mind Hungary. At those council summits, you know, there's the prime minister of my country, as an example.
Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte.
Yes, he has spoken out against the homophobic laws in Hungary this summer on Poland, saying that they shouldn't qualify for EU funding. And it's good that he does that. But at the same time, he's conveniently overlooking the fact that for 11 years he's been sitting next to Mr. Orban. And, you know, what did he do until this summer? I'm not aware that, you know, that he took action. It's all very... And I'm not blaming him in particular, but just as an example of how these people are sitting around the table protecting autocrats, protecting homophobes, protecting racists. And that's what they're doing.
There are people who often say, well, some of my American friends, for instance, who would say, well, why doesn't the EU just kick out, you know, Poland and Hungary and Slovenia?
Well, I think there's a couple of things I'd like to say about that. First, if we were to say, oh, well, you know, just leave, as the prime minister of my country said about Hungary, and I think he was incredibly mistaken to say that.
It's my intention on this point to bring Hungary to its knees. They have to realize they are either a member of the European Union, and so a member of the community of shared values that we are. That means that nobody can be discriminated and must feel free on the basis of sexuality, skin color, gender, whatever. Or get out.
Now, first of all, you abandon the people in those countries, and there are many very democratic parties, but also other democratic forces in those countries, and increasingly so. And I actually have to say, I am very, very impressed to see how those people are really fighting the good fight, and they don't take democracy for granted. I'm very, very wary of this caricature that is emerging of the enlightened, democratic, modern, efficient, clean West, and then the Eastern Europeans who cannot do democracy, something like this. That's really complete rubbish.
Autocrats in the European Council, you know, they've also used anti-Semitic tropes to smear, among others, yourself. Tell me what happened between you and Prime Minister Janez Janša of Slovenia during the visit there by the European Parliament's relatively new Democracy, Rule of Law, and Fundamental Rights Monitoring Group, of which you're a prominent member.
He refused to meet with us, which is unusual, because we have also been monitoring Malta, Slovakia, Bulgaria, and there, you know, we would always meet with the head of government, the head of state, ministers, etc. So, but he didn't want to meet with us. But he's been sending out some really ugly tweets. Of course, the temptation is very strong to react. And some people did, but I thought, you know, he is just trying to distract from what it's really all about, namely the fact that he too, like his example, Orban or his other hero, Donald Trump, are trying to destroy the rule of law and democracy, and he is aiming to do the same in his country, Slovenia. So I actually prefer not to talk about his tweets because they're gross and unworthy of a government leader, and certainly a government leader that is holding the EU presidency.
I mean, on the one hand, I agree with you. We don't want to repeat the lie. We don't want to repeat the grotesqueness of this kind of thing. On the other hand, I feel like sometimes we really need to ring that alarm bell really loudly and say that when you accuse somebody of working for George Soros, you are making an anti-Semitic remark in some ways.
Yes, but I think the thing is that you're not going to win that battle on Twitter. You'll win that battle in the political arena. You know, we can have debates which are very intense, fierce on substance, but never ad hominem, never rude or gross. You know, they say show, don't tell. So let's not fall into the trap. Let's not get dragged into a very ugly Twitter fight, because, you know, that's not going to convince anybody. His staunchest supporters are not going to be convinced, but people who are a bit sort of in the middle, they're going to, you know, if we are going to do the same, he is slinging mud and you sling back mud, then people are not going to be convinced.
So have you blocked him yet on Twitter?
Oh, no. I'm not even terribly interested in him. I mean, I think this is getting so much visibility, so much importance, whereas there are some real issues in his country. I mean, because I don't care what he's saying to me, but look at how he's going after journalists, independent bodies like the Court of Auditors, the Anti-Corruption Watchdog, the Data Protection Authority, the National Ombudsman. He and his party and his government, they are using slaps, you know, these libel suits and even criminal charges against journalists and against these other officials in order to intimidate them, to actually get them to leave and to be quiet. And I think that is what is extremely worrying, rather than some ugly tweet.
Now, this wasn't your first rodeo with Janez Janša. There was what happened when he tried to show a film in the monitoring group's hearing. You said, no, you can't show your film, and you stuck to it.
The hearing is organized for the benefit of the members of the European Parliament. The viewing of a video can be part of the monitoring exercise, but it is not meant for a session which happens to be web streamed.
And he ended up leaving the session in kind of a big huff.
I've been told that the Prime Minister has disconnected. So I take it that the session was not to his liking. I'm sorry he feels that way, but I do not think it's appropriate to send a video at the moment that a meeting starts without stating any reasons why. We have never done something like this before.
I'm wondering, what does that tell us about the autocrats' playbook for the EU?
He clearly wanted to use that session, and it was a public session at his request, which is very unusual, because usually we do these things in the relative serenity of in-camera sessions. But he clearly wanted to make a big show out of it. I suppose he was communicating more to his supporters than he was with us. And again, we've always had an exchange with the government leaders and the ministers and what have you, even if we were extremely critical, even if they were involved in criminal activity, even if they were autocratic, you know. And it's very unfortunate that he chooses to do this.
It's not explicit, but you do seem to be worried that if these autocratic forces continue to advance, one of their goals will be to destroy the EU's democratic elements. There's a kind of subtext there that we are seeing a kind of slow motion EU coup.
Yes and no. Well, first of all, as much as they rant against the European Union, many of them actually receive or benefit somehow from EU funding or otherwise from EU structures. So I don't think that they're actually out to destroy the EU. I mean, look at Viktor Orban.
Not the EU itself, no. But perhaps some of its democratic elements.
Yes, but not even the European Parliament, I think. They're out to use the EU bodies, and not just the Parliament or the Commission or the Council, but also, and very much and increasingly, the European Court of Justice. Because they have, it's a kind of network of parties and organizations which have an agenda which is very much built on the idea of, as they themselves call it, restoring the natural order, which is, of course, white patriarchy, huh? To be clear. And they're pushing this agenda at national level, but they're also using instruments like the European Court of Justice for strategic litigation, to fight gender equality, to fight LGBTI rights, to fight secularism, sexual and reproductive health and rights and what have you. And they also use the European Citizens Initiative, which is a kind of a petition that enables people to collect 1 million signatures to put something, you know, to call for legislation. So they actually know how to use the EU to push their values agenda. And they do it a lot more in a much smarter way than progressive forces do.
Sophie, your remedy has a few different strands to it. And one of the key strands is to sort of overthrow the European Council, the UGO, the Unidentified Governing Object. Quote, it is up to this parliament, this European Parliament, to overthrow the monarchy and establish a true separation of powers. And as you've recently written in a blog, which is sort of updating your book, you call on the Venice Commission, which provides legal advice to a broader body of nations than just the EU, to investigate the Council as to whether there's an effective separation of powers. Okay. Now, Sophie, is there popular support for overthrowing the Council, even in the Netherlands, beyond your allies, say in the D66 party, and beyond, let's say, this new-ish pro-EU party, Volt? Doesn't this kind of talk, and I'm not saying I oppose it, but doesn't this kind of talk risk creating even more disenchantment with the European project because you're directly impinging on the sort of hybrid governance model?
Well, first of all, to be clear, I'm not calling to overthrow the European Council. I am saying that the European Council should be brought into a democratic system which, you know, applies the basic democratic principles. And I don't care if it's hybrid, sui generis, or whatever, the basic principles of accountability, separation of powers, and all the rest have to apply. Secondly, is there a lot of support? I don't know. I'm just sort of, you know, I've just issued this book and I'm raising these issues and then we'll see if there's support. But could I more easily just echo ideas which already have a lot of public support? Probably. But I'm not interested in that. And I do think, I mean, I'm genuinely very worried about the state of the European Union. And it's not so much because of the attacks of the populists, because they are still not the majority. And they have suffered quite a bit from the COVID period. It's the weakness and the disenchantment of the pro-Europeans, because they see that, you know, they want to move ahead with the European Union, but they see nothing but stagnation. And that is a problem which lies very firmly for, I don't know, 85% in the European Council. So if we want to serve the citizens, then we have to get this situation unstuck.
But we've seen how overriding other member states can be used to inflame populist contempt for the EU. And there is a a kind of example of this, which is often cited. In 2015, the prominent Luxembourgish politician Jean Asselborn used a majority vote to introduce this system whereby each member state would need to take a certain number of migrants to relieve the pressure in countries like Greece, where they were arriving in large numbers. Now, I believe Asselborn did the right thing, but it didn't work, and the policy was never put in place. And if anything, that move by Asselborn toxified and sort of froze progress on migration in a way, like Viktor Orban might argue.
You still want to have a Western society in Hungary? You just said.
Because of the migration, now it's more complicated. Because we would not like to have multicultural parallel societies based on migration and so on. So we don't have that approach. So now the difference between the Western part of the continent and the Eastern part is obvious because of the migration question and the consequences of that on the political scene.
So isn't this national veto a vital part of EU hybrid governance, however flawed that governance might be?
No. First of all, there are vetoes only in very few policy areas, basically foreign and security policies and some parts of the budget. In all other policy areas, it's qualified majority voting, including the example you give, asylum and migration policies. Why was there a backlash? Well, people are always talking about the backlash by the populists. There's also a backlash by pro-Europeans who feel they cannot defend the European project anymore. And why the example that you gave, why did that happen? It wasn't a backlash against a decision that was taken. It was sentiment whipped up by some government leaders. And it's not limited to right-wing groups, because let's also look at the treatment of asylum seekers by the Danish socialist government as well, countries where we know there are violent pushbacks, there is torture and violence against refugees and asylum seekers. Those people are sitting around the table and none of that is mentioned. They're quiet because their peers in the European Council refuse to address this. They refuse.
To move on to another aspect of your remedy, it's essentially to transfer significantly more power to the parliament. And this has a lot of different elements to it.
Yes. This is about how we make politics. How are we going to make the EU as a whole a parliamentary democracy is the theme of my book. How are we going to shift from a fundamentally intergovernmental system with a parliamentary twig to a fully-fledged parliamentary democracy with all the checks and balances, separation of powers, and what have you.
Well, I mean, somebody might say, well, we shouldn't discuss changing the treaties of the European Union. It might do more harm than good, they might argue, because we have seen member states actually reject these changes. And that has been interpreted, those rejections of those changes, has been interpreted as Europhobia or as kind of Euroscepticism.
No, but the thing is that you cannot defend the European Union by ducking the argument, and that's what they've been doing. I mean, constitutional changes and institutional changes are being debated everywhere, every day in national politics. It goes right to the heart of how we organize our democracy. You know, I have no magic wand. I don't know how to force the government leaders and the national politicians to take responsibility for the European Union. But if they don't, it will fall apart. As a matter of fact, it is already disintegrating. The trend can be reversed, but it takes action.
One of the things you'd like to fix is this lack of dynamism in the European Parliament and make it more of a gladiatorial arena.
The title of my book is The Scent of Wild Animals, which is a quote of the founding father of my party, who was a real convinced parliamentarian, if you want. And he said about the Dutch parliament, I really love the scent of wild animals in this place. You want me to read this out? Yeah. So, I love the scent of wild animals in this building. The founding father of my party, Hans van Mierlo, famously said about the Dutch parliament. He saw politics as an arena with the smell of blood, sweat and sawdust, a battleground for the confrontation of ideas and ideals and for the clash of the political titans. In the arena, we smell the fear of our opponent, or we smell victory. Adrenaline rushes, nostrils flare, all senses are on full alert. The public loves the show. They come and watch the fight of the gladiators and the big beasts. Supporters come to support and cheer their team, their champion. The fascination of the public with politics lies firmly in the game and the spectacle of the battle. A gladiator fight behind closed doors is not interesting. And the point here is that the European Union is always portrayed, in particular by the government leaders, as a technocratic entity. Also because if they say it's technocratic, that means that, you know, the citizens have no business interfering, and the national politicians tell the citizens, okay, don't just leave it to us. It's only technocratic, and politics we do at national level. That's a lie. And it's a deliberate lie to keep people away. And if there is a scent of wild animals, that is where citizens think, hey, hang on, something is happening there. I want to know what's happening. And, you know, hey, there are personalities I like or I dislike, and there are views I share or I don't share. And this is why the populists are a lot smarter about this. They're creating this clash of ideas because they say, yeah, we're not in favor of gender equality. We're against LGBTI rights. We favor the traditional family. Now, I'm horrified by their views, but it's about emotion. It's about values. It is about ideas. And instead of running away from that and trying to reduce the European Union to something technocratic, we should rise up and say, hang on, this is all about values, but we have different values. We have a different proposition to the voter. That's the clash of ideas that we need in the political arena.
You want a question hour, fine, but if you wanted to get rid of the current sterility, that would imply getting rid of this endless parade of members of the European Parliament, each reading out a kind of set statement in what you write is devoid of any sensory experience for the citizens. No smell, no blood, no sounds, no cries, no growls, no adrenaline, sterile like an operating room. And the current plenary meetings of the Parliament end up being an easy ride, right, for any head of state or government who shows up there. There's no real challenge. So would you favor making these sessions a real debate with only one speaker per group so as to create, well, kind of a more jungle-like atmosphere where you would have a set number of people interacting with this one person? Wouldn't that just do so much more to actually start holding the council to account?
Well, yes, there's a lot we can do in terms of organizing the debate, but not everything. Yes, I agree with you. I'm very, I really don't see the point in, you know, 3 to 4 hours of 1 minute speeches. I mean, what's the point in that? People are just reading it out to use for their social media posts. There is no debate. So yes, I believe maybe one is a bit, is not enough, but like to have 2, 3, 4 speakers. I mean, if you have a handful of speakers per political group, the possibility to intervene, because that has been completely eliminated because of COVID, you know, that would already make the debate more lively. But I think, in essence, what will make the debate lively is what's happening in that arena. And that is why I think it is important to break the taboo on using all the tools that we have, including the biggest bazooka of all, elective tools. We have voted the Commission and the Commission President into power. We also have the power to vote them out of power.
As Sophie said at the top of the show, the European Council and its 27 heads of state and government can't be voted out by the Parliament. But Sophie is talking about voting out a different body, the European Commission. The Commission is part EU civil service and part EU executive. And it's come under fire in recent years for failing to do more to enforce EU law. Here, Sophie is musing on why the Parliament has never used the powers it already has to boot out the Commission, and why it might be a good idea to give that a whirl.
Now, When I say this, I see my colleagues looking at me as if I'm Che Guevara, you know, some very dangerous dangerous revolutionary or something like that. But I wonder why. I mean, I'm not saying that we should send them packing today, but to even completely exclude the possibility when forcing a resignation, a motion of censure, is a completely normal tool in any healthy, robust, mature democracy. What's the problem?
I mean, to be cynical about this, you're saying, let's pick a fight, either with the council or with the commission. And once we have that kind of oppositional drama, we have the attention of the public and we can start talking about the really substantive things.
No, I'm not saying we should pick a fight for the sake of picking a fight. But what we're doing now is avoiding fights. We're trying to smooth everything over. We're telling people, oh, no, there's no fight here. It's only technocratic. You know, don't worry. It's not political at all. It doesn't concern you. And this mandate, I think, this particular weakness shows is that the biggest groups, they tend to make compromises, which is a good thing in itself because democracy is all about finding compromises. But in my view, as a political group, you first have to put down a very clear and strong position on a certain topic. And then you sit down with the other groups who've done the same, and then you make a compromise. Now what happened was that the group leaders would withdraw behind closed doors, hammer out a sort of a joint text, so it wasn't even a compromise, it was a joint thing. And then afterwards, you know, nobody will know, is this a liberal thing? Is it a socialist thing? Is it a green thing? Is it, you know, there is no clash of ideas. And that you need to make clear what it's all about.
And so for me, that's the one thing that I really don't understand, which is why are the political groups so supine? What is going on that they do not come to Brussels with the same fire in the belly that you are expressing and you often show?
I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I wish I knew, but it's very worrying because any democracy that has a weak parliament has a problem. But I can see a couple of factors which have contributed. One is COVID, because it means that people didn't get, you know, the real feel of parliament, because for a year and a half they've been looking at a screen and meanwhile sort of feeding the babies, cleaning the kitchen, getting groceries, etc. No smell of wild animals. Secondly, there was an extraordinary number of new members after the elections. In my group, for example, 75%. You know, they haven't had much time to find out how it works. There's not been much time for bonding in a political group. And then indeed, there's been a lot more interference by the government leaders than I have ever seen in my political career here. Yes.
What does that look like?
Well, the fact that the council managed to take back the power when it came to appointing the commission president, but also, you know, in one stroke, also deciding on all the other jobs, including the president of parliament itself. I mean, that was something, you know, I was just flabbergasted. You know, what the hell? I mean, we were in Strasbourg, and I believe it was a Tuesday evening at 11 o'clock, we heard that there was a candidate, and the next morning at 9, we were voting. Go like, hang on. Now, I had been here before, so I knew Sassoli, and a nice guy, no problem.
That's David Sassoli. He's a socialist who's been the president of the European Parliament since 2019. He may need to step down after a midterm reshuffle that's expected in the coming weeks.
How can a parliament accept that that kind of decisions is taken elsewhere? Now, of course, there always has to be a kind of package in order to ensure that there is a, you know, a geographical balance, a man, woman, political, what have you, and that not all the jobs go to, I don't know, or the Germans or the French or whatever. So there has to be a degree of coordination. But what I feel now is that, I mean, I hear it even now, that the connections being made between the internal elections in the European Parliament at midterm and the election of the council, the European Council president. And I go like, you know, this, again, the whole issue of separation of powers, it hasn't sunk in. And I think that is really a big problem.
A little bit throughout our talk, I've tried to highlight some of the current weaknesses of the European Parliament and some of the European Parliament's own flaws in terms of the way that it operates. The group system is frankly bizarre. It seems to be based on making alliances to assemble enough MEPs to get speaking time and a significant amount of money. I might add that you and Mark Rutte, Dutch Prime Minister, you know, you share the same honor of being attacked by Janez Janša of Slovenia, and of course being part of the same political group in the European Parliament. But what more do you actually have in common there?
Good question. First of all, I disagree with your assessment that it's a sort of a random selection of MEPs who only come together for speaking time and money. Because if you look at the actual voting behavior, group cohesion is for most groups somewhere between 90 and 100%. So even in pre-COVID times, we were only registering the roll call votes. So by definition, the delicate, the difficult votes, and they're still. Group cohesion would be between 93% and 95% or something like that. So there is some real cohesion. Now, are there differences, for example, between my party and the VVD? Oh, yes. But I think there are two extremes that I will use to illustrate where we are. One is the Dutch parliament, which has 150 MPs, 150 seats, 19 parties, 19. It's completely fragmented. It's unworkable in my view. The other end of the scale is, of course, US Congress, which only has two parties. Now, within those two parties, or within each of them, differences are also huge. They're actually bigger than in my political group here in the European Parliament. So the European Parliament is a bit between the two. It's not as fragmented as many national landscapes, because we can see it happening more and more in other countries as well. I mean, Germany, we're now looking, I think, for the first time at a three-party coalition at federal level. And the other extreme being the two-party systems, where the differences within those parties are very big. But there's still a lot we have in common. And I think a lot also depends on what the parties do at national level may differ slightly. I mean, it may be based on the same principles, but there may be a different tone of voice in Europe or indeed at local level as well.
Sophie, you put your hat in the ring for the presidency of your group Renew, but then you withdrew. And we now have a member of French President Emmanuel Macron's party who's going to be the president, who is the president, and a first vice president who's a member of Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte's party. Is there like a structural issue with gender balance in the Renew group? And more broadly, doesn't this show how kind of parliamentary groups, including the Liberals, often don't live up to their ideals?
Well, look, this is a question that my colleagues will need to answer, because I was, you know, I'm a woman and I came forward. There was another woman who came forward for the position of deputy leader and she was voted down. I pulled out because I saw that there was this deal between the French and the VVD. But I can only, you know, I cannot say what their considerations are and how they see it. All I can say is I look at the results and I see that in 70 years, that's seven decades, there's only been one woman leader of our political group. One. Simone Veil. And that was 40 years ago. That was like 1982. So, do we have a problem? Well, apparently we do. And then, you know, the only, as far as I know, the only woman deputy leader we've had was me. We have, in the real top jobs, we have hardly any women. Yes. And I think so. My only conclusion is, again, I cannot speak on behalf of my colleagues, but I'm just looking at the results. And yeah, I think it would have been great to have the second woman in 70 years and the first one in 40 years. Yes.
That's it for this episode of EU Scream Book Club. EU Scream's nonprofit journalism is supported by listener donations, partnerships, and by advertising. And we're grateful to the Laura Kinsella Foundation for an annual grant. For more details and for more episodes of EU Scream, visit euscream.com or euobserver.com/EU-Scream. I'm James Cantor. Thanks for listening.